Hello everyone and welcome to the Smashy Business Show. Today is Wednesday, April 16, 2025 and I'm Abdul Majid Awan.
And I'm Warid Ahmed and we have a lot of topics for you today. Now, firstly, we're going to discuss how Majid Al Futtaim has announced a 5 billion dirham investment to transform one of the best malls, I would say, in the UAE, Mall of the Emirates, also known as MOE. Now, secondly, Dubizzle Group has bought UAE's property monitor portal. Thirdly, team ownership could actually be the next step for F1 in Saudi Arabia, and Dubai's property market is seeing a lot of rising prices and investor demand in Q1. And we're also going to be telling you about how Saudi-born Barnes Coffee is actually eyeing an IPO on Saudi Tadawul. And finally, I would say this one's really interesting, and I would say tune in until
some
the end to find
news,
out.
Basically.
Basically, Mark Zuckerberg actually basically wanted to separate Instagram as its own company in 2018. So we're going to discuss that, but there's a lot happening.
Yeah, there's a lot happening. Let's quickly start with Majid Al Futtaim. They have announced a 5 billion dirham investment to transform Mall of Emirates. There's a lot of details that will come out eventually. You can go to our socials and watch the news. But that's equal to nearly $1.3 billion. And the announcement comes as the popular Dubai Mall, not the Dubai Mall, the mall in this mall in Dubai, celebrates its 20th anniversary this year.
Now, the transformation plan includes expanding the mall's retail space and adding new wellness, culture, and dining areas. Now, it's part of a larger vision to keep the mall fresh and attractive for both residents and tourists.
And Khalifa bin Braik, CEO of Majid Al Futtaim Asset Management, said the goal is not just more space, but a better experience. He said the company is creating a place where people can shop, relax, and be inspired all in one destination. The interesting thing is Mall of Emirates has become very crowded in the recent history. Whenever I go there, you go through metro or you go through car, it's become really crowded. So I think it is about space and then everything else.
You know what it is with Mall of the Emirates? I feel that it will always have such a special place in my heart because I used to work there.
Yeah.
I used to work there. I spent a lot of time there. And honestly, let me tell you, it is way better than Dubai Mall, where I literally walk 10,000 steps when I go. And I'm just tired. I think.
No, but I think Mall of Emirates needs more space. It's such an iconic thing that people, if you come to Dubai even for like one day, you will go to MOE and Dubai Mall. Dubai Mall for the Fountain, which is closed now, by the way, the last show is happened or is happening? You sent something on Dubai.
I have no idea, honestly.
But yeah, it's going to close down for nearly 3-4 months. But I think then people won't be going there. But there's Dubai Aquarium. There's a lot of stuff in Dubai Mall.
Nice shopping there.
Yeah, but MOE is like one of the first biggest mall. I remember there's this something first attached with it. So let's see. We'll tell you all the plans as soon as we know it and as soon as they come out, and we'll do a story on the socials.
You know what it is actually, Majid, with MOE? I would say it's a family mall.
Yeah.
That's what.
Dubai Mall is a family mall. There's a lot of space for everyone in Dubai Mall.
Somebody who's actually worked there, and I've analyzed every kind of crowd that walks in, because you know when you stand at the front of the store, and I go to Dubai Mall a lot, it's different crowds. It's such different crowds. Mall of the Emirates, it's more for people who live, you know, in Barsha, you know, the outskirts.
Yeah, that's nearer to them, right?
It truly is such a family mall. And you know, just on the topic of Majid Al Futtaim, that's a Carrefour that I shop at, like, every week for groceries. Is that the one that you go to?
We have Ibn Battuta Mall near our house, so we usually go there. Otherwise, we have Discovery Garden Pavilion, other pavilions in the Discovery Garden area.
That's actually so interesting, because just yesterday, me and my friends were discussing how, so In-N-Out right now is actually open in Ibn Battuta until they sell out. That's what they said. They said 3 p.m. or until they sell out. Yeah. And me and my friends were like, who the hell goes to Ibn Battuta?
Everyone.
Really?
That whole area, Ibn Battuta Mall, is one. It was it's the biggest mall in the region, at least Middle East region, with a cultural thing attached to it. I don't exactly remember what's the biggest thing, but because it has a lot of pieces where you can go see old culture. There's this instrument which was used to I think measure the movement of the moon and everything. So it's like a very culturally relevant thing. The thing is, it's on one side of the Dubai area, like it's not in the center. So that is why a lot of people don't go there. But yeah, malls. We'll discuss malls in detail someday. Today we have a lot of stories. So let's move on to the next one. The Dubizzle Group known for its digital classifieds platform, has made a big move in the UAE property space. It has acquired Property Monitor, a leading real estate data and analytics platform based in the UAE. The deal comes at a time when Dubizzle is reportedly exploring a potential IPO in the region.
Now, Property Monitor is well known for offering automated valuations and detailed market reports. Now, it serves over 7,700 users monthly, including major real estate agencies and developers. Now, the platform is considered a key player in the UAE's property tech space.
And Dubizzle says the acquisition will boost the value it offers to clients by providing deeper market insights and a more data-rich experience. The move strengthens the Dubizzle Group's position in the real estate sector, where it already owns Bayut and Dubizzle.com.
Now, Dubizzle also plans to expand Property Monitor's tools by adding demand-side data. Now, CEO Haider Ali Khan says the deal opens new ways to support agents and developers, making Dubizzle a more powerful platform for the UAE real estate market.
And this is Dubizzle Group's third major acquisition in 2 years. In 2024, it bought Egypt's car marketplace, Hatlai, and the auto platform Drive, and car platform, basically, Drive Arabia. Altogether, Dubizzle's platform attracts 47 million visits and 15 million users each month. It's one of the biggest platforms, I think, together with what's the other one?
Which one?
Property Finder.
Yes.
It's like a competitor to Property Finder. Both of them, they have their own pros and cons, but yeah, it's happening.
You know that song, Majid? You know that song from Dubizzle? That ad. It's an Arabic ad.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember the tone.
I won't sing it because I'm a really bad singer. Yeah. But that ad plays in my mind all the time.
It's like insurance markets, Alfred.
Alfred
is so famous. Dubizzle's theme is so famous.
Yeah.
But yeah, talking about being famous, Saudi Arabia could be taking its next big step in Formula One by owning a team. That's according to Prince Khalid bin Sultan Al Faisal, chairman of the Kingdom's Motorsport Federation. A lot of reporters were in front of him and they asked him a lot of things, and he said there's a strong interest, especially with Saudi already hosting a Grand Prix and sponsoring the sport, to buy a F1 team.
Now, speaking ahead of this weekend's race in Jeddah, Prince Khalid said team ownership is not out of the question. He explained that if a team is bought by a company under the Saudi Arabia's public investment fund, it would be a business move, not just a passion project.
And Saudi Arabia first hosted a Formula One race in 2021. Its state-owned oil giant Aramco is a global partner of Formula One and the title sponsor for Aston Martin's racing team. In 2021, the PIF, Public Investment Fund, also invested in McLaren and owns a 20.5% stake in Aston Martin, the car maker.
Now, the chairman of Aston Martin's racing team, Canadian billionaire Lawrence Stroll, may be looking to sell his stake. Now, investment bank Renault Group has been brought in to explore this option. There's also rumors around the future of the Alpine team, even though Renault says it's not for sale.
And other Gulf countries also have F1 ties. Qatar's sovereign wealth sovereign fund QIA has a stake in Audi's future team. Bahrain owns part of McLaren, and Abu Dhabi CYVN Holdings, we recently discussed it, is also invested in McLaren Automotive. The Middle East now hosts 4 out of 24 races on the F1 calendar.
Now, F1's popularity is booming, especially among younger fans and women in the region, with rising team values and global attention from Netflix's Drive to Survive. Saudi ownership of a team could be the next big headline.
And it's very interesting, coming at a time just before the race. And a lot of people on social media interacted. We just did a quick quote share of him. Sometimes some stories are not like detailed stories. A quote can work. But interestingly, that if Saudi Arabia someday owns a team, it's going to be like, again, we always talk about Saudi doing power moves. So if Saudi somehow owns a team, it's going to be a power move. Because right now, all the Middle Eastern countries like Qatar, Bahrain, all these countries, they are heavily invested. No one still owns a team.
Honestly,
so they
Majid,
can be the first one to own a team.
I don't think that it's a possibility. It is definitely going to happen. It's definitely,
going,
definitely
to happen.
I think the trend that we saw is that firstly, they took over the football teams. They're like, okay, we're taking these. Now, secondly, they took over the best footballers in the world. And we saw that with Ronaldo, Benzema. I don't know if I should add Neymar to that list.
He is one of the best,
He is one of the best players in the world. And now they're like, okay, we're gonna take one of the best teams in the world. And I'm so excited to see which one it is.
The interesting thing is that this is not a new number. I remember it from 2-3 years ago. That the minimum that you can buy an F1 team is for around $1 billion. And I think Saudi has that money. Their PIF is like nearly $1 trillion.
I mean, they might give Donald Trump $1 trillion in May.
Yeah, so $1 billion is not like way away from them. It's just that they're cutting costs and they're streamlining all their financials. So maybe not now, but soon enough, it can be a reality. It's very possible. So let's move on from Saudi F1 racing, Dubai's property market. You can't live in this country without talking about the property market,
to be honest.
So Dubai's property market continues its strong growth in 2025 with prices and investor interest rising across key areas. A new report was published by Bayyut yesterday, and this data is from that. Again, we just talked about the Bizzle Group, which owns Bayyut. So new data from Bayyut, a major UAE property portal, shows that property prices increased in both apartments and villas during the first quarter of 2025.
Now, villa prices in Damak Hills saw the biggest jump, up by 21%. Now, in the apartment market, affordable areas like Dubai Residence Complex and Dubai Silicon Oasis were the most searched for. Mid-range buyers, JVC, Business Bay, and Al Furjan led the way. Now, luxury buyers preferred Dubai Marina Downtown and Arabian Ranches.
And more than 45,000 property sales were recorded in Q1 of 2025, the first 3 months, worth over 142 billion dirhams. Around 29,000 of those were off-plan properties, with the rest being ready-to-move-in homes. The demand is being fueled by Dubai's strong economy. Obviously, we always say these things, and they are true. Tax benefits and population growth, now over 3.8 million.
Now, for investors looking at rental returns, affordable apartments in areas like International City and DIP offered rental yields of up to 11%. Now, villas in Damak Hills 2 and Serena also gave solid returns. Now, even luxury homes in Al Sufuh and Dubai Creek Harbor showed yields above 7%.
And according to the report, rent prices also went up in many areas. Affordable apartments saw modest rent hikes, while some high-end three-bedroom units in Dubai Marina and Creek Harbor saw small drops. Meanwhile, five-bedroom villas in Dubai Hills estate jumped in price up by 75% due to new projects.
That is crazy. I mean,
it's nearly double.
You know, honestly, I always hear my dad say this, but his biggest regret was never investing into Dubai Hills when the project did come out.
Now it's becoming because of Dubai Hills Mall, it's becoming a center.
No, even the area, by the way. Yeah. I went to the area, Majid, and the restaurants that they have there, and they're not even in the mall. They have like Maze Tacos. They have this really nice Korean spot that I'm not going to try to pronounce on here, but they have really nice things there. Now, Bayyut CEO Haider Ali Khan says Dubai's property market remains very strong, especially in the luxury sector. He added that new sustainable communities and tech tools like True Broker are helping buyers find trusted brokers and make smarter decisions. Now, with this topic, Majid, when I think about it, I think of Damak Hills 2.
Because the prices went up.
They did, by the way. Yeah. And because I'm a resident there, I think the sad reality of prices going up is, you know, for homeowners, that's like hallelujah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, finally, if we sell this home, we're going to get profit.
Or if we rent it out, we can rent it out for a high price.
But I feel really bad for the people. A lot of people we knew that used to live there and they had to move.
Yeah, because the rents are going up and they can't afford it.
They had to move and they didn't just move somewhere else. They moved to an entirely different city.
Yeah.
So they went to Ajman, they went to Sharjah. And I think this is the... But they're celebrating though. They're telling me that the food in Sharjah is really good.
Is really good. I've tasted it. I know I can agree with them. The important thing is that all the regions, it's a very nice report. We'll do something on it. We'll make a whole infographic on our social media. Follow us on social media if you're listening or watching. The main thing is that they've broken it down to high-end areas. If you can afford like 200,000 per year, those areas are Dubai Marina, etc. Mid-range is Al Furjan, where I live. Thankfully, thank God it's mid-range. I want it to stay mid-range. I don't want it to go up.
Don't jinx it.
Yeah, but I still think JVC, JVT, all these areas, Dubai is quite big. On map, it looks small, but it's quite big. And Dubai South is being developed. Dubai Land is being developed. The airport area, near the new airport, Al Maktoum Airport, that is being developed. So I think there's still space to build. Dubai Hills Estate, the most interesting thing that I see when I go there is the EMAR project. You look at it in the night when the lights are on and they're working on it. It's so majestic, even when they're building it. So I don't know when they complete it, how it will look. It looks great already. So let's see. That area is also like gaining traction. 75% increase in prices.
I mean,
that's you invested 1 million, you can right now come out with 175 million.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so good for that. I know Pretty Little Things, Umar Guy, he and the famous Hollywood American.
Naomi Campbell?
Naomi Campbell. They opened their office there because there's a business park there as well. So they opened their office there. I went with the restaurants. I went to this one Russian place. Really nice food. Don't remember the name.
It's like Russian food. Is it good?
Yeah, it was great.
Really?
They had like the same thing, like steak, etc., but their own flavors.
Ooh.
So even the honey cake that I ordered was different. It was a little bitter. The usual honey cake that we eat from Carrefour or any place.
Spinnies has the best honey cake.
But those are sweet. They had a bitter one. So I was like, okay, maybe you guys have it there. But it was nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's move on to something bitter as well. Coffee. Saudi Bond. Barnes Coffee is eyeing an IPO. So it's a Saudi homegrown coffee chain, Barnes. And it's preparing for a possible IPO on the Riyadh Stock Exchange, which is Tadawul also. It's also called the Saudi Exchange, a lot of names. The company is working with the Saudi Capital Market Authority to get approval and is also in talks to hire banks for the offering.
Now, Barnes CEO Mohammed Al Zayn says the listing could raise hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, the money will be used to grow the business. Now, Barnes aims to have 1,000 stores by 2030, up from 850 now. Now, new branches are planned in the UAE, Oman, Kuwait, and Morocco.
And the company, founded in 1992, already operates in Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Egypt. While there's no exact date yet for the IPO, it would join several other Saudi firms looking to list this year, even as markets face ups and downs. We know because of who.
Now, Trump.
Yeah.
Now, falling oil prices and global trade worries have made markets extremely shaky. Now, the Tadawul Index has dropped around 3.6% in recent weeks. But if conditions improve, Barnes could be one of the next big local names to go public. Now, the brand is owned by Al Amjad Trading and Manufacturing.
And this new IPO thing, when the whole crash was happening in all the markets, nearly last week and last to last week, the saddest part for me was seeing Nice One go down. And Nice One went down nearly 10%. That's the limit. If you go, your price goes down more than 10%, your trading for that day is suspended. So they went down 10%. There was another one on Saudi Tadawul Exchange. Completely forgot the name.
Alpha something?
No. Alpha Dhabi is an Abu Dhabi ADX. But there was another one which went down. And it was recently IPO'd. So the funny thing is that the new people who came into IPOs in end of 2024, a lot of them faced a lot of problems when this crash happened. So I think for long players who have been there for 20 years, it wasn't a problem because they came from a very low point and they increased over the year. The newer ones saw a lot of problems.
But you know what it also is, Majid, when I'm taking a look at this story, I think, you know, F&B in the Middle East is like, it's really popping out. You know, you're seeing spots become like globally famous, and much more than globally famous. I think what's really signaling that there's this shift in how consumers are actually behaving is the fact that a lot of us don't buy Starbucks anymore.
Yeah.
We don't buy Costa, you know, Dunkin', Krispy Kreme. We go to local cafes.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's Barnes Coffee, as we just mentioned. There's also this bakery. It's called Libre Bakery.
Oh.
So it's the Qatari bakery that just very recently expanded into New York, opening the first Qatari ever cafe in New York, and there's also Half Million in Saudi.
Yeah,
so you have all these different brands, and then in the UAE you have Home Bakery. They have really good coffee.
Yeah.
You also have Knott Bakehouse, Trio. So it's like all these local spots. They're making really good products, and I think that's why they're becoming such a success. I remember I was speaking to this consultant who works for Accenture, Majid, and I was just throwing ideas out there, to be honest with you. I was bored. I was like, oh, I should open a cafe. It seems really easy to do one.
No.
I was just saying that. Listen, I was just saying that because that's a trend here.
Yeah.
Every single couple of months, they give us a new one.
Yeah, new
you
one.
Know? First, it was Trio. Then it became something called Dip. Then it became Knott Bakehouse. Then Orto. Yeah, I love the scene. I do. But it's like I've noticed that. And she told me, she looked at me and she was like, actually, it's one of the most difficult businesses to open and to run successfully. They don't have a high profit margin.
Yeah.
They don't usually make profit quickly. So the fact that, you know, this is happening right now with Barnes Coffee, this signals such a huge success. And it's the fact that we've changed. We've all changed so much. And of course, the boycotts have definitely attributed to it, by the way. But I think that it's almost kind of a stupid explanation to always say that, oh, I'm buying from this brand just because I'm boycotting Starbucks.
Yeah.
No, it simply is the product is so good. I cannot even look towards Starbucks.
You know, in economics, there's this one indicator of a country doing well. You can like enlarge it to other regions as well. So when people start buying local stuff, that means that your country is doing good because your country, when they have their basic needs fulfilled, like water, air, blah, 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 they go into venture mode. So they want to start their own small things, like a small business, even tiffins. Like India, I remember like 5 years ago, there was a big tiffin culture. Every housewife was starting a tiffin service where they told their son to, how many people do you have in your office? 50. Okay, I'll make food for them every day. They can pay minimum amount. So when your local brands and local industries grow, that is one of the very biggest indicators that your economy is doing good and your country is doing good. And the idea that you put in front of the whole detail that, this is coming, and everyone is buying local, that shows that UAE, Middle East, they have developed so much that they can source good stuff, good products, and make something out of it.
And I think with what you just said, Majid, it's really great because of the fact that we're seeing that, you know, that's why, you know, country like Syria, even Morocco and Libya, they're not doing as well as the Gulf.
Yeah.
And it's because they fell into this pothole of not having their own free markets, of relying on debt, of not having, their own free market that almost kind of runs itself. And I think this is why a lot of people were actually not that excited, I would say, according to the comment section, to hear the fact that, you know, Saudi Arabia, according to Reuters, it's clearing off Syria's $15 million debt to the World Bank. And I would say that, you know, they were just saying that that's just them becoming reliant.
Yeah.
And it's completely true. The economist Dambisa Moyo said it best, you know, aid is dead. It's so dead. Yes, you receive it and it's great and it clears this weight off your shoulder.
Yeah.
But the problem's not gone. The root's not gone. Yeah. You have to really cut it. The market has to almost run itself. And that's why a business like Barnes Coffee is going on to Dawood.
The main thing that you talked about, Syria, I always say the recovery is very important and how they recover. If they recover by making their own industry, like relying on their own stuff, great. If they still start importing stuff from other countries and not make, like, grow their own local industries, I don't think they will survive. And even, like, to be honest, even a developed country, if they start, like, neglecting their local industry, their local producers, local makers, local entrepreneurs, just if we talk about F&B even, if you stop focusing on your local brands, eventually someone takes over and it's a very bad economic takeover. Remember, we did a long discussion on this that you go to any country, you'll find like 10, 15 American brands that have to be there. And if they're not there, for example, if I go to some country and I don't see McDonald's, KFC, Pizza Hut or anything, I'll be like, what happened to this country? And immediately the first thought that comes to your mind is, oh, this is not a rich country. It's not a developed country. Mm. They don't have KFC and McDonald's. But maybe sometimes you go and look at the local scene, it's great. A Middle Eastern local scene, a lot of them, the funny thing is, one day I was having a chat with my wife, and she told me that, very interestingly, all the big brands that have become big here, they're opening their stores in London and all these places. And whenever our rulers visit there, they go to their shops especially. So see, it comes from the leadership. It comes from the brands themselves. Their expansion is eventually like promoted by the leaders. So we saw Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid go to London because usually when it's hot here, UK weather is good. So a lot of people move.
You're completely right, by the way. And I see this with them. There's basically this cafe here. It's called Caillou. They're pastries. Oh, my God. I need to, like, show you right now. They have things that, like, look like mangoes.
They have a store in London? Or like
They have a store in London. So they have a store. Look at this. Yeah. Look at this magic. They have a store here. They have a store in Saudi. And they have a store in London.
Nice.
And it's you need to go. It's absolutely insane. I would say their croissant. I have never tasted a croissant as good as the one sold at Caillou. It's even way better than Paul, which is, you know, French. So
if you can make it better than them.
Yeah, yes. I think that's telling you enough. And remember that cafe that we were also discussing, the one that, you know, they call it the Starbucks of, they call it the Starbucks of Saudi.
Yeah, half million.
I keep forgetting the name for some reason. They opened a store in London. Opened a store in London. So there definitely is a
London is like the next spot after your Middle Eastern expansion, when you've covered the Middle Eastern countries as much as you can. The first spot is London, because a lot of our leaders, a lot of people from the UAE, a lot of people
from
Saudi,
they love London, by the way.
They go to London.
They're obsessed.
During the off season, like the winter,
London,
summer season.
Switzerland, and Germany is like, you know, Gulf people's, it's like one of their favorite summer spots. Yeah, it is. But Majid, just back to what we were talking about, like the aid and how, like, here, it's the fact that they have their own local consumer products and their own free market. And, you know, aid doesn't help that much. I think what's positive about Syria is that we know what the aid is actually going into. Like, for example, it's to pay off 15 million to the World Bank.
15, I think.
It's $15 million. It's to pay off $15 million to the World Bank. Qatar, the investment that they're making, it's to finance Syrian salaries in the government. We're actually being told what's being done with this money. But then, you know, there's, I think they'll definitely fall into a corrupt loophole if it's just, you know what it is? If it's just money being handed off and it's like, here, take, this is aid that you can use.
Yeah.
I think the fact that these Gulf countries, and by the way, if you notice, European countries, the West, when they make, like, when they give a country aid, notice how it's just always this, like, this reason of, oh, to, like, aid humanity, the humanity there, and to reconstruct, there's not actually an aim there. And that's why it gets lost in this, like, corrupt loophole where the money gets taken and it's used for something else.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how the Gulf, when they gave them that money, it's for a specific purpose.
Yeah.
It's a purpose that we're all aware of. Like, recently we covered this story on Lebanon, and it doesn't have to do with aid from one country to the other, but it has to do with aid in general.
Yeah.
And basically, what happened was that there's this $10 million rubble contract in Lebanon, and this contract is to basically clean out the rubble from the from Israel's invasion to Lebanon, because there's a lot of damage there. But what happened is that the Lebanon's government actually allocated this $10 million to this company called El Bunyan.
Yeah.
And
without any due process, like
no tender, no bidding, nothing. They just said, okay, they offered the cheapest price, we're going to give it to them. And it's cases like these where I think that, you know, it's cases like these where corruption stems.
Yeah. So talking about corruption, it's a very weird segue. I don't want to talk about corruption and Mark Zuckerberg together.
My favorite topic.
But yeah, something like corruption is being asked of Mark Zuckerberg. It's not corruption per se, but it's like he bought Instagram and WhatsApp because they were competing with Facebook and nearly defeating them. So details-wise, in a surprising reveal during a high-stakes trial, which is happening in the U.S. and which can see Facebook lose Instagram or basically divest Instagram and WhatsApp, a document has shown that Meta CEO, which was called Facebook when they bought it, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg once considered spinning off Instagram, basically selling it off or making it a separate company at least. Back in 2018, Zuckerberg raised the idea in an internal memo, worried that Meta might face growing pressures from antitrust regulators.
Now, the trial, which is happening in Washington, is part of the U.S. Federal Trade Commission's efforts to undo Meta's past acquisition of Instagram and WhatsApp. So he was definitely right about that. Now, in the memo, Zuckerberg wrote, "I wonder if we should consider the extreme step of spinning Instagram out as a separate company. At the time, Meta was planning to connect all its apps more closely, Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp."
But even as he pushed for integration, Zuckerberg admitted that breaking them apart could become unavoidable. He even predicted that what is happening will happen, that a future Democratic president might push for them to become separate companies. In the end, Meta didn't spin off Instagram, and all of the apps came under Meta, which was Facebook again in the start. Instead, it moved forward with merging the platforms more tightly. But the memo shows how seriously Zuckerberg took the risk of a breakup, exactly what the company is now facing in court. He even wrote that breakups aren't always bad. Sounds like relationship advice. But yeah, he wrote that breakup aren't always bad, saying most companies actually do better after being split up.
Now, during his testimony, Zuckerberg also admitted that Meta bought Instagram because its camera was better than what Facebook was building. And honestly, so true. I love, I don't even take photos with my iPhone camera, by the way. I take it with Instagram. He said the company was weighing whether to build its own vision or to just buy Instagram. Now, this has fueled the FTC's claim that Meta used a buy or bury strategy to kill off competition. And why is that a bad thing? I really don't see...
Antitrust law is very interesting. The FTC argues that Meta still controls a monopoly on platforms people use to share with friends and family, but Meta says that that's not true. Obviously, they have to say that, pointing to strong competition from TikTok, YouTube, and Apple's iMessage. Zuckerberg also admitted that most of Meta's attempts to build its own apps have failed, saying the majority of them don't go anywhere. So he has... There's two, three points, main points. One, they wanted to make Instagram a separate company. They didn't do it. Hmm. But Zuckerberg predicted that someday some guy will come and be like, bro, why do you have all these big apps? Hmm. So that's one. Second is the way he's defending himself is saying that we have so bad engineers, so bad app makers that we couldn't build something like Instagram, so we had to buy it. So there's two kinds of theories. There's buy and bury. Buy and bury is that whenever you see a good competition, you buy them or try to bury them by giving them very bad competition, lowering your prices or anything. They went for buy. So that's
not a bad option.
Yeah, that's not a bad option. But antitrust law is very interesting in this case. Very simple explanation is if you own a bank and you see another bank is trying to do better than you and there's only two banks in the country, you shouldn't be buying the second bank because then you'll control literally everything. Then you can raise the interest, you can do this, that, blah, 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 blah. Eventually, you control all the power in that specific sector or in with that product or anything. So that is why antitrust law is present in the U.S. It's not there in a lot of countries, but it's there in the U.S. And the Federal Trade Commission has put a case on them. It's a very big case because, again, some of these cases came to light in the recent, like, Telegram, we saw that guy was caught in France.
Pavel Durand.
Yeah, he's back in Dubai. The biggest case on him is that should the entrepreneur or the founder of an app be convicted for crimes which are happening on his app? He doesn't control all the things that are happening.
Can I answer that question?
No.
Honestly, can I answer that question?
Your opinion, yes or no?
Hey, I like Pavel Durov. He's an Emirati citizen. Yeah. I do not have a problem with him. I think he's a genius. Yeah. I want what happened to him to happen to me.
Like, he's the richest billionaire in the UAE.
And not just, I want the passport just like him. So no, I'm not a hater. But it's a no and yes answer. It's a yes answer.
No, but should be like, I'll tell you why.
I'll tell you why. Because something that I've actually noticed recently is that there's two types of CEOs. There's either the CEO who's like a micromanager who has his hands in everything, like all the skeletons, literally everything.
So he knows everything.
Yeah, not even knows. There are actually CEOs that partake in every single, like they have their eyes on everything. And then there's the CEOs that are like, okay, I hired you, do your job and micromanage for me so I don't have to put my hands on everything.
Okay.
So we don't know what kind of CEO Pavel Durov is. Which one is he? If he's one who does indeed micromanage and he's over everything, yes, he should be convicted. If he's not, then, you know, free him.
I think management style. But a CEO, for example, B11 example, very good example. Let's do it, like,
not
try it with B11. For example, the guy who made B11, the owner, founder, CEO, the main person.
I don't even know his
should
name.
He be convicted if someone dies of food poisoning by eating his products? Should
that's
he be
really,
convicted for murder or like attempt to murder?
Honestly,
no, right?
That's a really good question.
You can't. There's a lot of things that can happen in between.
No, in this case, I don't think he should. But
so same with tech bros, these tech guys.
No,
you can't say that.
It's not the same thing, though.
No, it's the same thing. I'll tell you now.
It's not the same thing.
With tech, it's very simple. You build Telegram, okay? Now there's a criminal activity happening on it, which people are using Telegram to do it, okay? You are the CEO, founder, blah, blah, blah. You should know, or at least someone in your team should have firewalls to prevent that, right?
Mm.
If you don't have that kind of firewall, that means your product is a problem. It's a problem for privacy. It's a very good thing for terrorists. The thing is, you can't convict the founder and CEO for something that other people are doing on his platform. So the thing is, even with us discussing it, there is no single answer on it. The point that I was making, that if Pavel Durov is found guilty, it will become a precedent. It's never happened in the history of tech that a founder has been convicted for the crimes other people are doing on his platform. So we should wish, and I think Elon Musk, Zuckerberg, every big tech founder will be wishing.
I think it's arguable.
No, it's not arguable. The problem is there is no precedent for it. It's never happened.
There's genuinely companies where the board of directors, the founders, and the CEOs don't actually know what their management is doing, what their employees are doing.
I'm talking about tech specifically right now. They know everything.
Yeah, but a company like Telegram, come on. You're telling me he does not know everything that happens on the app?
I refuse to believe that. No,
you know why?
You can come back to technicality. He doesn't know. The thing is, with WhatsApp even, you look at the WhatsApp, you open a new chat, you start talking to someone. The very first message that is there from WhatsApp is, your chat is end-to-end encrypted and even we can't read what you're talking about. So that's the very first message that you get on WhatsApp. That is the same with Telegram. So they provide the infrastructure to have a chat. They can't read your chat.
Yeah.
That is why Telegram was so much marketed for privacy. That, oh, we're private. We even don't know what you're talking about. So now, when you look at the broader picture, he didn't know what is happening. Because he can't read chats. He can't go into the data. So after he was caught in France, now he's the Telegram ruler of the whole regulations has a point there now. That if they think there is criminal activity happening, they can go in your private messages and see and share those messages with the authorities. So, yeah, the thing with privacy is that everyone, even Mark Zuckerberg, even Powell, even ex-Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, all of them are champions of privacy, that we don't read your messages. So now you understand that he didn't know.
I see your point.
He didn't know.
That is
the USP he's selling to people.
Yeah. Imagine, you know what this is? The story is also reminding me of Mark Zuckerberg. You know how he mentioned that, you know, TikTok can be considered competition?
Yeah.
So if you're on TikTok right now and you're watching, we're seeing how all these, like, Chinese suppliers are, you know, I don't think it's nasty. Honestly, I don't think it's nasty at all. I think Western media is pushing that, but they truly are. And they're telling everyone, like, you know, whether it's BMW, Rolls Royce, you know, we supply them.
There's a very famous meme going around on it as well, that the Trump hat, the MAGA hat, Make America Great Again.
Yeah.
So people have taken pictures of him and zoomed in. and there's a tag coming out made in China. And then people actually bought those hats and like turned them around and showed that, look, he's putting tariffs on China. He's like, no, 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 everything should be made in America. Mm. And then he is going on and wearing a made in China, make America great again hat. Shows you the irony of his tariffs and everything that's happening. 90-day pause is there. Let's see what happens after the 90-day pause.
But basically, what's it called? Yeah, so the Chinese supplier videos. And I was just reading the comment section, and I saw someone say, oh, my God, please, can you tell us where to get all this from before they catch up to you and they remove your videos from the app? And then I was going to respond to her, by the way, and be like, hey, TikTok is owned by China because ByteDance owns TikTok. Yeah. And then, no, someone already got to her. They're like, girl, China owns it. Like, don't worry about it. And I think this is why TikTok was going to get banned at some point. There was a point where, you know,
they have a 90-day pause right now, and it's ending nearly. We need to find, I need to get updated on what's happening with TikTok. We need to get updated in the U.S. Soon the 90-day pause is going to end for them as well. Let's see what happens with TikTok.
Yeah, let's see what happens. And that's a wrap for today. Thank you so much for tuning into the Smashy Business Show. Make sure to follow us across all social media channels at Smashy Business. And stay ahead with our daily newsletter. You'll find the subscription link in the description.
This has been a Smashy Business Show, a Smashy Business production, part of the Augustus Media Podcast Network. Big shout out to our 1.5 million monthly listeners. You guys are like a family to us. We come to you and talk to you every day now.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for making this possible. Keep listening and keep sharing our podcast if you like it. We're trying to do more and more topics so you get a lot of information every day, wherever and whenever we can find it. And do so, follow us on social media. That's the most important thing that you can do today. Bye-bye. Take care. See you tomorrow. Thursday it is. Second last day before the weekend. Yes.